Over the past 3 years, citizen dissent has become a constant all over the world, and finally here in Canada, people are realizing the loss of their social, civic, and human rights. Right now, the biggest threat to democracy in Canada is Harper's Omnibus Bill, C-38, a bill that refuses to let the people know its full contents. Pass the bill. We'll tell you the details later.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
No more watchdogs. No more environment watchdogs. No more accountability by the government. It's not to be questioned. This is the action of a government that no longer allows for democracy. Perhaps those of us that are still uninvolved or unaware of just how close Canada has gotten to the dark age could go back to the warnings of Jane Jacobs, who in her 80s clearly pointed out in her last book just how our society is failing. Today's show, A Dark Age.
This seems very creepy, this mass amnesia. And it seems like the most weird and probably informative occasion of a dark age. It's only part of a dark age because a dark age, in effect, is a dead end of a culture. Very sad thing. We all, I think, understand the principle, use it or lose it. And I believe that is what happens in the mass amnesia part of a dark age. That's why it's forgotten. It isn't used anymore. This is true of the famous dark age that followed the collapse of the Roman Empire. Amazing loss of knowledge and interest in what the people used to do. That's how the classical age disappeared and never again revived as a living way of being. But it's also what has happened to the many Aboriginal cultures in North America that were conquered, and the pillars that they depended on taken from them and no longer used, like the lands that sustained them. Ways of hunting and foraging and dressing and crafts and their religions. Very, very similar to the European famous Dark Age. And again, it was a case of use it or lose it. In some cases of a Dark Age, the losers are unable to practice what they did in the past or retain it, because it has been the foundations of it have been taken from them by conquest usually. But it's even more mysterious and just as final in the case of dark ages that are lost to rot from within, not from conquest by outsiders, stronger outsiders. And in fact, the losses from interior rot are probably harder to climb out of. Although I wouldn't say that categorically, I'm not sure enough about that point. But they're hard to climb out of anyway. And there's been some progress in learning what this interior rot is and how it happens. Some of it only in very recent years. Those of you who have read the brilliant Pulitzer Prize-winning book Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond will recall that he has quite a theory and a lot of information about what makes losers and what makes winners in these cases. And he is very clear about the internal rot that occurs. This differs, of course, depending on what period of history is being handled, and what were the qualities of the culture while it was alive?
One of the signs of interior rot that you speak of is in a chapter with the, to my view, wonderful title, Credentialing versus Education. Credentialing versus Educating. And I'd like to just, if I could, read a short paragraph from your book and ask you to comment on it. The more successful credentialing became as a growth industry, the more it dominated education from the viewpoints of both teachers and students. Teachers could not help despairing of classes whose members seemed less interested in learning than in doing the minimum work required to get by and get out. Enthusiastic students could not help despairing of institutions that seemed to think of them as raw material to process as efficiently as possible, rather than as human beings with burning questions and confusions about the world and doubts about why they were sinking time and money into this prelude to their working lives. Could you expand a bit on that, the issue of credentialing versus educating?
Yes. Like many of the rots that occur, the people drift into them. They aren't done. The trouble is there are unintended consequences to most actions, and there were unintended consequences certainly to the drifting in of credentialing into universities and colleges, and most recently to community colleges, I'm sorry to say. They weren't intended to ruin education, but in many instances they did, and the attitudes and values behind them have been very pernicious. I thought when I wrote this chapter, I'm going to be in trouble. A lot of my books are used in university classes. And this is kind of a black eye I'm giving universities and colleges, and they may not be very happy about using my books in that view. Well, I thought, it can't be avoided. This is truly what's happening, I think. And when you're in a quandary, it's always a good policy to fall back on the truth. So I worried a little, but so what? That's a small matter. To my amazement, though, I found that the students and faculty and other people, many other people connected with universities, were even more worried than I was about the very same things. So I needn't have wondered about this. In fact, the first excerpt from the book was that was bought by a university, and it was the one that described credentialing and how we fell into it and the harm it had done to educating and the false values on which the credentialing is built. It was bought by the University of Virginia. Everywhere that I've spoken, and with people that I've corresponded, they have faculty and, well, not students anymore, because they've gone through it, but faculty who remember how it used to be have verified the decline and what it consists of. Now, this brings up the subject of feedback. These five pillars that I identify, why those five pillars? Because they're stabilizers. And any living organism, including a city, which is a very live organism, but a culture is also a very live organism, or it's dead. Any one of these depends on stabilizers, on correcting mistakes, just as much as our own bodies do. if we hold our breath too long, or if we eat something poisonous, or don't get enough sleep, or whatever. There are mechanisms in our bodies that help correct these things and keep us alive. And if they don't work, too bad for us. These stabilizers, when they go, then we are in serious, serious trouble. And the same is true of a culture as it is of a body or a forest or anything else. Now, how do these stabilizers correct the mistakes in the culture? Very important to know that. They do it in all kinds of ways. We don't correct our holding our breath too long the same way as we correct, you can think of a million things that can go wrong. And they are, but they each have their own way of correcting. I don't go into detail because I don't want to go into what my mother used to call organ recitals. But in general, if we want to generalize and turn this into an abstraction, but not forgetting that it's really very concrete, we must be aware of the phenomenon called feedback. That's how all these corrective and protective elements of that kind in a culture or in a body or a forest or anywhere, that's how they work, with feedback. There's negative feedback and there is positive feedback, and they work differently. Positive feedback works like an addiction. It's not corrective. It just keeps making itself worse, as addictions do. Negative feedback, surprisingly, from the name, is very corrective, because the feedback that comes in of that kind tells the organism, whatever it may be, that, hey, this is happening incorrectly. This won't last. You'll die if you go on like this. And it has certain built-in actions programmed to make you stop. Now, in the case of stabilizers that have gone bad, these are not supernatural, you know. These are human mistakes. And they are correctable, then doable by human actions. And the problems are no bigger than the mistakes. Maybe I'll go into a little more of that later, but that's why I'm basically optimistic.
Are you saying that the education systems, our universities and colleges, are not feeding back to the community at large the way they once did? They're not taking a critical position vis-a-vis the community at large?
That's true, but it's not only the universities and colleges that are neglecting to do that. It's all kinds of employers who are neglecting this and who are maybe even leading it and pushing it. I'm not sure. They're depending on universities and colleges to do the tedious first winnowing of who they should admit on the grounds that anybody who can endure 4 years of a university is likely to have certain good qualities from the point of view of the employer. That can be a government, a bureau, or can be a private employer. In the past, there were other ways that communities and cultures did this. If somebody was an Eagle Boy Scout, that was a kind of first winnowing. There used to be colleges of heralds, which granted coats of arms. And they didn't mean, you know, if they granted a battle axe or a shield or whatever it was to a family, which henceforth would be considered upper crust, it didn't mean that the person getting the coat of arms could wield a battle axe or a ball. It just meant that they were top dog for the time being. And acceptable, all kinds of opportunities open to them that would not be open to non-gentlemen. I won't say, I'm just putting this in terms of gentlemen, not ladies, because coats of arms were really handed down from the paternal line. Not the maternal battle axe line.
One of the things that surprised me about the book, and I'm just going to read a short paragraph from the book and ask you to comment, but perhaps while I'm doing that, if there are people who have questions that they want to address to Jane Jacobs, they can begin lining up at the microphone here. So I'm going to make one more point, and then we'll throw the questions open to the floor. One of the things that surprised me about the book, I expected, I suppose, you to be critical of cutbacks in arts education, etc. But I was surprised by your criticisms of science. I thought before reading the book that we may be getting lots of things wrong in our culture, but maybe we were generally getting the science part of it right, but that's not the way you see it. I want to read just a paragraph here and ask you to comment briefly if I could. Our culture has survived much bad science in the past, such as phrenology and claims that men with dark skins and women of any hue lack the intellectual capabilities of white men. Why can't we continue surviving bad science? To people who didn't venture more than a dozen miles from home, it didn't matter whether the world was round or flat. Bad farming practices in the past resulted in poor yields and depleted soils. Today, chemical fertilizers, toxic sprays, and doses of hormones and antibiotics to livestock endanger not only soils, but also the health of farmers, farm laborers, consumers, and the environment. Modern life has raised the ante of knowledge required in everything from science to democratic participation. Failures were always stultifying. Now they can be devastating.
I want to backtrack a minute because I was forgetful and add a P.S. to the previous question and just make the notation, which you probably... most of you have already thought of, if you've been connecting the dots, the feedback on the credentialing versus the educating first came from the students, the ones most affected. And that began in the 60s when they began to, in some places, especially California, to object to the way they were being treated. They were the first to notice it, and they were first to notice how pernicious it was, and also its dynamic. Now, this is true of most feedback. Whatever is most concerned with it is the first to recognize the feedback that is needed and to deliver it. And a lot of our troubles come from not noticing the feedback and not crediting it and not valuing it. Conflict is a form of feedback. When you have conflict in your community, especially that is carried on for years, something is blocking some of the feedback, whether it's bribery, which is of some kind or other, which is not always money, or barriers set up to part of the feedback, something or other is going wrong there. And even without knowing what is the feedback and what it's telling us, when it goes on for years, it's worth thinking about and examining and debating in the open as much as possible. What is the situation? And far from it being debated openly now, it's considered to be decided and not worth thinking or talking about much anymore. Well, that's behind you. Well, you'll see in the future whether it's behind you or not. People who don't heed feedback, they find out in very sad ways the penalties for that. Dark ages, which is one reason I wrote this book, are terrible ordeals. I wouldn't wish them on any culture or on any people. It's a miserable way to live.
Why don't we go to the floor?
I'm from a small rural township, and I'm part of a committee that is looking into trying to attract development to our town, and in by way of attracting businesses that might give opportunities for employment. And the question I would ask you is, we're just beginning, what would you suggest as a first step?
Well, the first step, which hasn't been made anywhere,
I'll take notes.
People are getting interested in it in quite a few places. Zoning is the chief toolkit of land planners, who are the chief kingpins of how a great deal of what we call suburban sprawl is settled and decided on. This toolbox consists mainly, it consists entirely practically of zoning, which is predicated on three powerful anti-urban assumptions, whose date I know because it was the date I was born. I remember it. I don't remember being born, but I remember the date. In 1916, zoning came to North America. And these were the three chief assumptions behind it. High ground coverage is bad. High densities, that's numbers of people or families per acre, are bad. Mixed uses are bad. Well, all you can make by following those assumptions is what we call suburban sprawl. It's impossible to create lively streets or vibrant cities or settlements at all with those assumptions. And what's odd is that they're questioned very much. Nowadays, they're questioned to the point that the planners with these toolkits despise the results of their own efforts. And what we need is a different kind of zoning that I like to call performance zoning. It's how things behave, not what they're named, or even how they're described. In Vancouver, a councilman to whom I was talking in a public conversation like this read what the bylaw said a restaurant is. Well, you wouldn't believe that description, how you could describe what a restaurant is without any reference to food. But it is. That's the way the bylaw is. And in that case, they were worried about noise, and I'll tell you in a minute why that's important. And a restaurant was allowed to have, that fit under this particular rubric, was allowed to have two performers. And this has this is a different kind of performer than performance zoning, yes, surely, but two performers operating it, but no more. And so the councilman reading this says, and this was to be a protection against noise, he said, a restaurant can have apparently two silent mimes, but if it gets three silent mimes... now, if you go to zoning hearings, you find them always full of conflicts, where there wouldn't be a hearing, probably. Well, they aren't talking about zoning. They don't. People at these hearings aren't really, they think they are, but they aren't. They don't really care whether there are 26.4 individuals per acre or 28.7 individuals per acre. Who cares? This is not an important question. But they are scared to pieces that a change in zoning will hurt them and their property values and the future of their community. What they are really talking about, if you listen, is certain real dangers. There are real dangers because awful things can happen. They're not every neighborhood is scared about the same things, but they're scared. And by listening at various zoning hearings, so what people were really saying, I compiled a list, and any community can do this for itself. My list included people are afraid of noise, they're afraid of through traffic, they're afraid of bad smells, they're afraid of losing their views, they're afraid of crime, they're afraid of losing beloved landmarks, they're afraid of losing a pleasant scale of streets, especially horizontally, that they become attached to, and they think that with a zoning change, which might very well be true, that there will be buildings put in there that will shatter that scale. They're afraid of losing their piece of sky and sunlight. Well, and other things too. But any community can find this out. Oh, pollution, they're afraid of pollution. And by finding out what really is the fear, because there wouldn't be a conflict if there was no fear, you can find out what kind of protection is needed. Every person and every neighborhood in a suburb or in a city needs protection from bad performance of something new that might be inserted. And furthermore, this needs to be standardized, like decibels for sound that escapes the premises, a place where excessive noise is forbidden, or certain scale of buildings where, and certain protections of landmarks where that their destruction is feared. And all of these things can be specified so there will not be favoritism and confusion about them, all except bad smells. I'll come to those in a minute. Furthermore, they have to be enforceable. Well, apparently, land planners have either been too much intimidated, I suspect this is partly true anyway, by the vociferous public that they have miseducated or helped miseducate for generations by telling them that they're protected by zoning, by anti-urban zoning. They've been too much intimidated to rethink this. and really get more of what is needed and will really work. And it can keep on being adapted when necessary. Or else they have been so indoctrinated by their teachers and so pleased at being in a learned profession that it just jars their happy notion of what the world is like to change this. But it has to be changed because the present system is counterproductive and mostly nonsense. And the land planners themselves have begun to recognize this and to even to start working out maybe not ideal systems, but changes. Vancouver is in one of the leadership positions of this.
You are listening to The Other Side of the News on 93.3 CFMU FM.
And it works in Vancouver. A lot of discretionary, what's called discretionary zoning, because they know that the present kind of zoning is so bad it won't do any longer. But they don't have a systematic substitute for it. Discretionary zoning has its drawbacks. Not as bad as anti-urban zoning, but it does have its drawbacks, and it's worked at all, as far as I can see, in Vancouver, and worked pretty well, because it's a city with an almost singularly uncorrupt government.
As reluctant as I am to interrupt Jane Jacobs, I see there's quite a lineup of people with questions, so with your permission, I'll ask for the next question.
Fine, and you should shut me up when I ramble on too long.
Go ahead.
Hi. I would love you to comment on the medical model, and the sense that I'm thinking is that the medical model has embedded itself in our way of thinking, right down to relationship. And so it seems to be destroying, at least it seems to me, to be destroying our ability to form and sustain relationship and community. And I was wondering if you have something to say about that.
You were asking a question about the medical model, meaning, can you elaborate on...
Sure, the idea that the way to look at the world is to diagnose things, fix them, make prognostications about how things are going to go, that everything has a normal range and things should always be in the normal range.
Yeah. Now, this I can't answer in a couple sentences. This is one of our most important problems, and nobody is to blame exactly for this, except, as always, people are to blame for not thinking deeply enough of it and trying to correct it. Science, ever since we started having it, which is not very long, a few centuries ago, it has depended on comparing two things with each other, like comparing rats that are fed vitamin A and rats that are not fed vitamin A, or children that are taught to read by this method or taught to read by that method, or any number of things. And that's the way practically all biology has been learned, the medical things, by comparing two things. Sometimes it's two individuals, and sometimes it's two communities or two groups. Why this attachment to pair comparisons? Because it's quite easy to compare two things. As soon as you put a third thing into the mix, it becomes far more difficult. and a fourth, a fifth, a sixth thing, forget it. It's so difficult. And yet, in the real world, practically everything, maybe everything, is connected to something else and affected by something else and affects something else. And you cannot get a true picture of the real world or anything approaching it by dividing it into reductive pairs and thinking you've got a good answer and an informative answer. In fact, we get a lot of harm from this kind of thing and discover it later, like hormone treatments or like... because there were other things that weren't included in the pairs that were compared. Or, the carbohydrate diet, for instance, does make people lose weight. And if you just compare those two things, weight by people who follow it and weight by people who don't, that you've got something true. But it has been discovered that you are also missing folic acid, which is essential if you abandon all grains, for instance. And this has been verified, and this is very crucial because women who go on this diet and don't get folic acid give birth to babies that have really dreadful birth defects. And this has, some doctors began to suspect this, and some public health workers. And now Canada is protected against this to a certain degree by what's called enriched white flour. You've probably seen it on bags. The white flour is enriched. Well, it's enriched with folic acid. And the birth defects of the particular kind, they're caused by deficiency of that part of the food, have dropped dramatically in Canada because of this enrichment. But that's a case where a third thing came in, you see. But who knows how many other things are in those grains? Who knows how many other things should be compared? Now, we must wonder why the human race has gotten along as well as it has for quite a while with such bad science, with not being able to do anything effective with more than two pairs. And I've been worrying and wondering about this, and I think I have an answer, or possibly part of an answer. I think that this is why we are so attached to stories. Stories are a form of information that does show, quite naturally, how things are attached to so many other things and affected by so many other things. And even a quite simple story brings that in. It's the way we have been taught about the world. A quite true way, even when the stories are myths. I think we should be very grateful to stories. And these biological ones, when we get onto what's the train of events in that, are very much in the vein of stories. Okay, that's the good news. Now for the bad news. Instead of valuing the information that we get from stories and with valuing it, caring about how accurate it is and respecting it in every by criticizing it as well as valuing it, we have fallen heir to this thing that says that we call stories from real life anecdotal evidence and despises it and will not credit it with the advantages and the truth of science. Well, it's a different kind of truth than our bivariant reductive science, that's for sure. But that doesn't mean it's worse. It may mean it's better. In any case, it may mean that it's essential. And the picture I've just been drawing for you of science in its various progression and retrogression is really about the accuracy of stories, the meaning of stories, and the bad tendency to dismiss stories without thinking about them.
Next question, please.
Hi, Jane. How does a dim post-industrial city like Hamilton avoid a dark age?
Well, like any other place that's dim or not dim, by trying to do things right that have been done wrong, and by learning and paying attention to what's done wrong, by paying attention to feedback, to evidence, which is just lying out there in front of our eyes, a great richness. Sometimes you have to dig for the evidence. And I think that in the case of a dim post-industrial city like Hamilton, people have not dug deep enough to know what are the benefits to both sides of the conflicts that have been occurring and have not thought about these. In some cases, the benefits have been concealed. In other cases, the benefits are in the open, but people haven't applied themselves to thinking what they mean and to what they mean in comparison with the costs. If the benefits are to get across town in 4 minutes faster than you could otherwise, you have to think about that and what's the value of that in comparison to the value of what's being lost. If the value is economic, which of doing the wrong thing or doing the contested thing, is that economic? You have to ask, in what way is it economic? And again, what are you losing in the supposed economy? These need analysis and debate. Cost-benefit studies can be very deceptive, or they can be very revelatory. But they are not going to be helpful if everybody keeps quiet about them or doesn't question, is this really economic? How can something that has been, that billions of dollars have been poured into over 50 years or more, like traffic engineering, road engineering, and traffic management, and yet every new road that's done makes the traffic worse. This doesn't make sense. Something is wrong. It has to be rethought. Believe me, the traffic situation in Hamilton will not be helped by the road through the park. You'll see. But it's too bad to waste more money finding that out, isn't it? when it's uneconomic, when this has already been proved no end of times, but the feedback hasn't been credited. Did I answer that question about the biology and the medical?
Next question, please.
Hello, Jane. Have you experienced a particularly good way to get across to people your ideas where the result is they have been prodded to act on them? I'm interested because of my experiences getting universal design ideas across.
The only success I've had is when people already think these things. See, I'm not very inventive, and I haven't made these things up that I think are good or bad. I learn them from other ordinary people like me. I'm different from ordinary people in one respect, and this is what, and this bears on how I am able to get things across. I have an awful lot of self-confidence, and I think this is because I was not squelched as a child. And most people, I have deplorably little self-confidence, and they go through life in a crippled way, depending on other people's self-confidence. One of my children calls people who do this hungry ghosts, that they feel they must take the energy and time and the self-confidence of other people to bolster themselves. Well, I'm not against that, because that may be the best thing to do. Furthermore, they may grow into more self-confidence. So when I wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, I was doing no more than telling loads and loads of ordinary people like myself what they already knew, but they felt shy about saying, because they were ashamed that they might not be saying the sophisticated thing to say, or what the experts would approve. And if I helped any, it is only by giving some people, a lot of people, I think, the confidence that their ideas are right, and they don't need to be ashamed of them and hide them, and or be upset if they're called, you know, people who believe anecdotal evidence. And what is the device I have used for doing this? A wonderful device called the English language. I don't know any better way that there may well be, through videos and other kinds of things, better, but for me, and for what I have learned and what I was taught, I don't know any better way to do than express it in words. If you're a graphic designer, I think you said, you probably don't know any better way to, any better device than graphic design. Well, that's okay if you do it well and in a communicative way, that's fine, that's good.
Jane, first of all, I'd like to thank you for taking my question, and I'd like to thank the organizers of this event. That being said, I do have to set this question up with a wee bit of history, but I'll make it brief. Jane, I'm involved with a group called Water Watch, and you spoke earlier about feedback and how important it is to the healthy running of a city. Myself and some other citizens in the city of Hamilton think that public infrastructure like water and wastewater should be maintained and controlled in the hands of the public and not be sold off to private corporations. Now, I guess the mayor's not here. In any case, what's happened is the city took a bold new experiment 10 years ago to privatize the management of the water services, and several people in this city think it was a failure. There was a lot of problems with sewage spills and unaccountable costs. One of our aldermen is trying to find out exactly how much this program costed and he's been facing a lot of roadblocks by city council who didn't want to reveal this information, and he's had to go to a Freedom of Information Act to get this information and pay a lot of money for information that we think should be available in the city, in the citizens' hands. And we're trying to stop this because we think it's a bad deal. There's ethical and moral considerations about giving taxpayers' money to a third-party corporation that's really not accountable to the taxpayers, but only to their shareholders. And 16 citizen groups presented against this privatization and made a very good case against it, and one group presented for, and it was the current contract holder. And yet the city council voted to continue to go ahead and reprivatize the water and wastewater services. And since the Walkerton inquiry and Judge O'Connor's recommendations about openness, transparency, and citizen involvement, we think that the City Council ought to listen a little more closely to the citizens
The question is, Jane, how can we try and get some of the members of City Council and the mayor to realize the importance of feedback in the city and in the governance and management of some of these basic infrastructures? Thank you.
Well, I certainly agree with you that these things like the water supply should be in public control. And I think that one of the worst things that has been popping up in recent years are the entities called P3s, public-private partnerships. They're in another book that I wrote, The Systems of Survival. I call that kind of thing monstrous moral hybrids. They are, it's been demonstrated over and over again that they are just, they're time bombs waiting to become just as corrupt as something can, and as uneconomic too. But I take it from the applause that I heard that a lot of people in Hamilton realize this already. So this is not a question of how can the citizens learn this, but how can they make that learning effective? Isn't that right? There's only two ways in our democratic government to discipline councilors or other legislators. One is by denying them funds to run their campaigns, and the other is by the votes, not voting for them. I don't know of any other way you can do it. We certainly don't want guillotines. Although in some times and places, people have come to the conclusion that that's necessary. I don't. I think that's losing what we value, that kind of approach. But I don't think that it's losing what we value to throw the rascals out with votes. But that depends on citizens teaching each other, having a sharp eye and watching out for what's going wrong, and especially what is illegal that may be happening. What else? This is one reason I like helping people to develop self-confidence, because without it, citizens, no matter what their legal rights are, can't really exercise them very well. You have to be bumptious.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I often regret not being old enough to be nostalgic about the type of vibrant community life that presumably once existed in our society. But could it be that our culture, like Rome and the High Empire, was already unraveling under the weight of internal contradictions even in these so-called good old days? And if so, could it be a viable strategy to preempt a crash by creating counter-institutions, counter-cultures, counter-pillars, if you will?
Yes, you've got a lot of good assumptions right there. Now, let me see if I can keep track of them. Can you mention them one at a time again?
The possibility that even when in our culture we were apparently enjoying a good community life and healthy institutions, that it was already...
Was this hokum? A lot of it, a great deal of it was, and a great deal of it was for some citizens. Certainly, citizens affected by racism, there never was a good old days. They can be, or anybody else can rightfully be, nostalgic about, I think. There weren't very many good old days or places where there could be good old days for women. I would not have wanted to live in any time earlier than our own. I'd be crazy to want to. So there may be nostalgia There is nostalgia about times that never were, or that never were as presented. Cultures all seem to develop a mythology about a golden age in their past. Why is this? I think because they get into dark ages eventually, or near to them. And these are so much worse than what was in the past, that the past assumes the appearance of a golden age in contrast. That's pretty sad. It's one reason we should stay out of a dark age, a major reason why. There is no return to a golden age because there never was a golden age, not for many people. Now, there are some more parts to your question.
Yeah, I was comparing the possibility that times were somewhat better from studying history in some ways for people in the dominant culture. This is my assumption, which, correct or not, I'm asking if
I think that's true, but only for a minority. Mm-hmm.
But if so, could it be possible to preempt a coming crash by creating new institutions? I call them counter-institutions.
Yes, I think, in fact, that's the only way we make progress. It's very, very discouraging to try to reform institutions and ways of doing things that have gone bad or obsolete. And the way it has successfully been done, mostly, is by starting new institutions, which will be weak and small compared to what we've been depending on. But if they're good and if they're well adapted to what's needed, we can be sure that they will get stronger and more effective. And along with that, the failed older institutions will begin to wither away. This is life. This is life, ascendancy and death, no matter what, institutions or people. We wouldn't have any future at all if we didn't have young people and if we didn't have births. And that's where our hope lies. The young people who don't know how hard it is to move things even this much ahead, but that they can see the need for it and they work at it and they try it. And eventually they may get disillusioned, but a lot of them don't. And while this is going on, in whatever métier they possess, that's where we do get such progress as we have. And it's indispensable. And it's the same with new institutions and new businesses and new everything. We constantly have to keep renewing ourselves or we're lost. We're really lost.
This has been The Other Side of the News, and thanks for listening.
Redefining Radio.
CFM Radio.